let's talk about racism, but let's not talk about politics because we don't want to alienate these people. And it's like, you're so interested in not alienating people who are actively causing us harm, and you're not making any type of effort to make us feel good at all. And it's just that time old story of like, what about us? You know, like, where's all this? Why aren't you worried about us? Why do we have to do all this work to make people who are hurting us feel better when no one, not even you, who's supposedly on our side, is doing anything to make us feel not that bad?
This is the Bris Poinsett Show. This is the Bris Poinsett Show. For the world's most dangerous infomercial, I'm your host, Bris Poinsett. Along with my producer, Ada, we bring you this weekly commentary and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio of the Portland Art Museum. This is the best of the Bris Poinsett Show, the world's most dangerous infomercial. I'm your host, Bris Poinsett, and along with my producer, Ada, we bring you this weekly commentary and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio at the Portland Art Museum. You can catch the full show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7. You can also catch clips on youtube.com/Bris Poinsett, plus exclusive bonus content on patreon.com/Bris Poinsett. Make sure to follow us on twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM, that's numbers with a Z, or the Numbers Podcast Network on thenumberspodcast.com. Again, that's numbers with a Z, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Bris Poinsett Show, the world's most dangerous infomercial, and I have a special announcement. I have a semi-personal announcement. So as of September, I took over as the programs lead for Respond to Racism Lake Oswego. For those who may not be familiar, Respond to Racism, RTR, is a grassroots anti-racism group in my hometown of Lake Oswego, Oregon. I've been involved in various capacities with the organization before, but yeah, this most recently I took over programming, which means that I will be leading and curating events around the speakers, panels, movie nights, organizer trainings, most specifically our monthly community meetings, which happen as of right now, the first Monday of every month at Lake Oswego United Church of Christ. Love to see you there sometime. But for our meeting in September, I also debuted a project called Life After the Bubble, which features interviews with former students of color ranging from class of 2006 up to the class of 2021 who went through Lake Oswego schools. And not just do we talk about what you might expect, which are, you know, some stories around trauma, around racism in school, but also all these students were involved in resisting that, in building space for different marginalized communities in the school, whether it be through student groups, through programs. In one case, a student was pretty instrumental in what became the film studies course at Lake Oswego High School. So we capture all of that. And these videos from, well, right now it's fall 2023 through spring, summer of 2024, we're going to be releasing these interviews individually in full each month, because the idea is not just to capture these stories, although it is important because a lot of students doing the work are not connected to those who did the work before them, but also to spur the community and spur those, especially in the DEI spaces, to sharpen their work, to not just do cultural, you know, celebration events, which are important, but are kind of like the bare minimum. They're a start. To not just let the words of, frankly, people of color that make white people comfortable in the city dictate the anti-racism work of Lake Oswego. So to that end, I want to present to you this evening, or whenever time you may be watching this, a preview of Life After the Bubble. This features clips from all 11 interviews. again, talking about everything from casual Islamophobia post 9/11 to the downfalls of the district's DEI task force that they created in response to the Black Lives Matter, the George Floyd protest, down to just so many, many stories of casual racism and how it was handled by teachers, how it was perpetuated by students. And again, lastly, the groups that were created, the spaces that were created to support students by students in the face of all of this, in the face of the isolation, because it is important to capture this history. It's important to empower the community with this history. So with that, I present to you Life After the Bubble.
We are all the direct like stories of these major and easy to write about concepts of, okay, white flight happens, and then you get gentrification, which is right return, and then you have these students though, or these kids who like don't really know like what's going on. High school, I'm like walking across 43 at 5:30 in the morning to get on 35 to get to De La Salle in North Portland. And that's when I really started clicking with things. I'm like literally watching property values sort of decrease as you come out of the trees, right, that we take for granted, into cities, and then like apartment buildings that get like smaller and smaller. And now I'm on Denver Street from Ash, and like I see them, I'm like, these are different realities. And I think that like ninth grade year, leaving like Oswego and going to De La Salle in my Birkenstocks and my Bostons, and be like roasting me, like what are those? So my relationship to place really is the conversation, right, as a whole, like what does place mean, and how does it develop or determine who we become.
The thing that has always stuck in my memory as being like a very like defining theme of my experience through junior high and high school was the fact that like 9/11 happened when we were in like seventh grade. It was like start of the school year. And then like the Iraq war happening, and like just the onslaught of like sort of like vulgar media that teenagers really just like got like force fed at that time, whether it was like, I mean, just like the simple like hyper patriotism of Team America to like caricatures of like Middle Eastern people in like cartoons and media. A lot of that came back to like my experience of being like one of very, very, very few Middle Eastern kids at Lake Oswego High School. And just like, you know, like anytime something would happen in the news and you'd get like a little spike of talk about the Middle East in any sense was like something that I would hear about. And whether like it's, you know, the experience of like taunts and slurs from your classmates, or like being expected to be a expert or like a token spokesperson by your teachers, you know, it's like it's like on the one hand it's like, wait, am I supposed to be hated for this, or am I an expert on this, and you're supposed to like respect me for it? And there's like a wild push and pull of that. And you know, like for me, I'm like, well, I I grew up in I grew up in Mountain Park. I'm born and raised here. What do I know about any of this to any of you? Just being like in a way so totally confused as to how I would become like a face of that for some people. But that, you know, that really was like, you know, sure, it wasn't every day, but it's definitely, you know, it was one of those things where, like, looking back on it, it's like, oh yeah, I felt that a lot.
In LESS, when we start, like in middle school, when you start learning about racism, and there's like a racist occurrence in a book to someone of your race, and then suddenly you see all the white kids turn their heads towards you. And it's like, I can understand, like, yes, that person is of my race, but why are you turning the attention to me? I'm not the character in this book, so why are we all looking at me right now?
In sixth grade, you know, if you were in like a elevated math class or whatever, the one level up in like seventh grade math, whatever that was, they would put you on a bus, like a small bus, and there's a few of us from River Grove that went to Palisades. And then I think Palisades was sort of like the hub. And then, you know, a couple kids from the different schools would go and meet there for the morning math class. And I just remember, and it was a very interesting, like, you know, congregation of all these kids, because it was like kids from Palisades and Westridge and maybe another school on our side, and then River Grove. And so it was like a mix of all these different kids for the one class. And actually there's kids from, it was either Forest Hills or one of the other schools too, because there's Lake Oswego, you know, kids that would filter into Lake Oswego High School that were in that class. And so that's where I had a couple experiences with a student who didn't want to be in my group. You know, we were assigned like groups, like, hey, everyone, you know, you're A, B, C, D, you know, in your little group, but then everyone who is B went to the B table type of thing. And so we get into these groups, and this one kid, you could bleep out the name, but it was, he was like, I don't want to be in your group, or you're not welcome to be in our group, something of that nature, you dirty Mexican. And so I was like, what? And because the kid that he was hanging out with is like brown skin and like black hair, and that was like his friend, and I was like, maybe he was mixed or something, I have no idea. But I was like, bro, like, I, because, you know, I peeped who he's talking with the whole time or whatever. It's like, I don't know what ethnic enclave he's assigned to, but he's not white. And I just remember he was like, I don't want you to be in my group, you dirty Mexican. And I was just like, bro, is this real life? You know what I mean? This is not indirect, this is very direct. And I just remember that being crazy. And I want to say that I told the teacher that, and she was an old teacher. She might have been like in her 60s by then. But I just remember she kind of was like, it just was almost like she might have cared, but she didn't care enough to, like, you know, do anything about it. It was like, you're not even really my student. You're from another school. Like, it just seemed messy, or it just wasn't of value of her. Like, she heard the words, the audio went into her ears, and her brain processed it. But like the reaction that I got from it was just like, not like sympathy or empathy or care. It was just kind of like, this isn't a problem big enough to justify me, you know, doing anything about it. So that was one experience that was more of the like direct side for me, you know. And then at that point, like, all I could think of when that happened was like, I'm not even Mexican.
When I was younger, too, maybe more so, it was just like ambiguous brown, where they didn't really even know what I was. And so, like, most of the time I'd be getting that, what are you? And then they'd say, like, there'd be like, kids would be like, call me Mexican, like it would be a diss. Like, that shit never made any sense to me, or Chinese. And it would be like, there's like the brown cultures that the white people are most comfortable being openly afraid of, or what? But like, that's not a diss. Like, the homie's Chinese, the homie's Mexican, what is this, you know? And but they were just grasping at straws. And then, you know, for somebody who didn't grow up with brown people in my immediate family, that shit was even more confusing for me, you know, because I'm like, well, you know, I'm Anthony,
every stage of my life, elementary, middle, high school, would want me to choose. You know what I mean? And I was never like enough in terms of identity. And then, I mean, the level of like they made sure I knew it. You know what I mean? Like, it was crazy too, because it ended up kind of damaging me. I like straightened my hair. I relaxed my hair. I begged my mom to like perm my hair straight. And she, after like, you know, years of saying I'll never do that, did it, because I was like at the like in a really scary place mentally. It was stupid, like over my hair, because people were, you know, grabbing it and like cutting it with scissors during school and stuff. And like, I don't know, other things, like they would put like bugs in my hair. And then like, because, you know, I have like Afro text hair, shit just hangs in there, you know what I mean? And so like I would have to find them later, or people put like forks in my hair and I have to find them. So I told her, I was like sobbing, I was like, people are, you know, cutting my hair, people are, you know, putting in my hair, mom, like. And she decided to straighten it. And it's like she then fell to that too, you know what I mean? Like, she then fell to the people in my life also making it like horrible to be Black, you know what I mean? Never. She like, she was anthropology culture major, like she was so hard on being like, yourself, you are beautiful, you know. But when she heard that, it just hurt us both so bad. And it ruined my hair. I mean, now it's like growing back healthy, but for years it was, you know, straight and dry. And honestly, like, I'm going into it a lot, but the point is like it ruined me. I changed myself physically. I tried to light my skin, nasty shit. But at the beginning of my senior year or freshman year, I think I realized like I had to like slow down on that, you know what I mean? And like kind of realize, but that was hard. Like, it was finding identity before then, and realizing that it was okay to have curly hair, and that the people putting my hair was their problem, and like all of that traumatic, you know what I mean, wasn't on me.
You know, because you would get it even from your friends, and it's like, well, do you guys just like not have any other jokes, or like, you know, one of the other things that I was thinking about is like, you know, it is one thing to like joke about it with your friends and have that sort of like dark humor, and you know, you can for the most part tell the folks for whom, like, yeah, it is a joke, but at the end of the day, those jokes really do become grating. And when it's very one note and happens so constantly, I mean, like, you and I had some friends in high school for whom like it felt like the joke never ended, and it's like, they're really smart people, but it just, you know, you get sick of it. You really get sick of it, because they also didn't have a perspective of when to give up, or, you know, the harm that their words can cause and what those things mean. It's like, these are people that even to this day, I still consider my friends. Like, I bear them no ill will for that, but it's like, you could have maybe had like a little bit more empathy.
In sophomore year, yeah, sophomore high school history class with Mr. Moore, it was Cinco de Mayo, and one of his students was near the front of class. He was giving a speech, and he was kind of like well-liked by Mr. Moore. It was kind of like a little bit of a teacher's pet. I'm not even saying that to be facetious, but it was kind of true. So he was letting him like have the floor up front, and Nick was the person was wearing a sombrero. And it was Cinco de Mayo, and the person wasn't Hispanic or whatever. And so, and like Nick was just giving a speech just like normal. And then the bell rings, and then, you know, everyone just files out, about to leave. And then Mr. Moore says, class dismissed, and he says, see you, El Mico. And I just like sit there and I just say like under my breath, just real quick, I was like, that's racist. And like, I was just packing up my bags, and like, right as I say that, like bolts of lightning, Mr. Moore yells, David, come see me after class. And I was like, And like, and my friend Granny Grove was sitting right across from me. He like looks at me. He's like, "Dude, you okay?" So I was like, "He's like, almost like you want me to stay sort of thing." I was like, "No, just go sort of." But the whole thing transpired really poorly after that. So I, you know, just kind of sitting there grabbing my things, and he's like standing there next to the door. And pretty much most people have left, and he just gets up, you know, literally about 2 or 3 inches from my face, and was like, "You don't ever talk like that in front of me, in front of my class. You don't ever call me a racist." And I was like, "I didn't call you racist. I said what you said was racist." I said, "Oh, that's racist." And I was, and he was like, "You don't ever call me a racist." And he repeated that line like a few times, and I was, and I literally repeated the line, "I didn't call you a racist. I said what you said was racist." And literally that was like 2 or 3 exchanges, but I remember 2 specific things, that he was very, very close, and that when I looked down, like, his lip was like quivering hard. He was like very, very upset. And like, apparently when I said that, that when I was like, "Oh, that's racist," like that triggered him really hard, because I just said it kind of under my breath. I didn't say it very loud, and everyone's like leaving the class. I don't even think most people heard it. And then like, I remember when I said it, it was like, you know, you go to the doctor and you hit, like, they hit your knee, like a reflex. It was literally like so reflexive. There's nothing I could have done. I was like, because he said it as a joke, "See you later, El Mico." And I was like, "Oh, it's racist." I was like, literally, I couldn't avoid it. But it was just like, he was saying it so off, just as off the cuff, that I was just saying it so off the cuff. And then he just said, "See me later after class," like right away. And so I was like, "Oh, damn, really struck a nerve." And so the lip quivering, all that. I just remember leaving the class after that. My friend was waiting after me, and kind of just being normal. And then 2 or 3 days later, my mom and my sister like tell me, they're like, "Oh yeah, we met up with your teacher and the vice principal," which was at the time was Mr. Park, which is like, "Oh, Mr. Park and Mr. Moore." And then my sister, my mom, and I was not included in the conversation. And they just came to the conclusion, or like basically the logical like answer, that like, we're both very sensitive people. In that, like, we're very, I guess you could say, you know, outspoken. But this word "sensitive" was used very, very often. I was like, "Oh, he's sensitive, I'm sensitive." That's why it happened. But they totally didn't get the full picture. I wasn't even there. But so but at that point, Mr. Moore was just like very, very, like, on guard, very nice to the overwhelmingly nice. He was we had already had not a terrible relationship going on. We were pretty decent, pretty talkative. But I think like that just randomly struck a nerve for whatever reason. He was just like kind of bothered by it. Like he was, yeah, I remember just being like, "Dude, I barely even like," I like almost whispered, I almost didn't even say it just because it was so quiet. But the whole idea was like, what he said was kind of weird. And Mick is, I'm not gonna say lots, like give a person away, but he's not Hispanic, right? He's white. So him wearing that and kind of like being declarative like in front of class like that, it was kind of a little weird. The optics on it were weird. Like nowadays it'd be a little weird, just because it wasn't as like, you know, this wasn't trying to be like super, it's not like trying to be respectful kind of thing. So the whole idea of it was like, "Oh, this is already kind of weird. This person is doing this weird kind of thing," and the teacher's just kind of, you know, just being fine with it. And then he just says that thing. So I was just like, that was like the cherry on the top. So the whole idea was a little weird. And then the whole year goes by pretty fine. Mr. Moore is super nice to me. And then I've seen him like a few times outside of school, because he's super like, he's into movies and a few other things. So I see him like Lord of the Rings like release or something like that. I see him like the Matrix sequel release, something like that, like at the local Tiger Theater. And he's nice. He's just normal after that. But like a little over nice, just I think to make up for it, or just to like kind of have good like, you know, optics on it. But overall, like, you know, I always didn't have like fully like great like perspective on like him as a teacher up until that. And then that kind of like a little bit confirmed it. And then in general, yeah, the response was weird. Nowadays, like, I would have liked, the student would probably be more like involved in that, but they probably wouldn't be involved in the conversation just because they want to keep it with adults. And I get that to some degree, but honestly, like looking back on it, I like kind of retorted a little bit to my mom and my sister. I didn't want to like tear into them about it, obviously, right, in retrospect. But the whole idea was like, man, I really should have been included on it. That perspective was weird. I know the whole story. I have like very, very clear memory on it. I could like almost say a few things. Like we're in the conversation. So it's really like a case where, like, in general, nowadays, you know, the optics on it would be totally different. But, you know, that was more normalized back then. Nowadays, people wouldn't even say anything. So
senior year, I was in leadership class, and I remember the junior class was picking a theme for the winter formal dance or something. They were in charge of it, and they picked the theme Jungle Fever, and nobody knew. I guess nobody knew, like, the whoever the Miss Brown or whatever was the, I think, leadership teacher, and she like didn't know that the term had any other kind of had any, like, she thought it, I don't know what the fuck she thought it was, because I was like, you know, and then I called it out, and but it wasn't until after they had gotten all this shit printed, like the invitations and all this stuff, and I was like, what is this, like, what, you don't know, like, what the connotation with this or anything? She's like, well, I think I know. It's like, I'm like, you know, she's like, oh, it's that Spike Lee movie about the guy who delivers pizza. And I was like, no. And they eventually, like, reluctantly, like, I think changed it to something. I don't remember what it was, but they changed it. But, like, they made me feel like I was fucking weird for just, like, pointing it out, that I'm like, you're an adult. Like, you were, like, well into your 50s. Like, you should know, like, this thing. But it was, like, a lot of this. It was, I don't know. It was just a very, it was a very white-centered, like, point of view.
A school counselor came in and raped me out of special ed to get me to, like, a meeting with two other white kids, where they basically just tore me down the entire time. And they called my mom because I was sobbing, and my mom came, and in front of the two kids, they told my mom that I should go to a Title IX school, that I need to be in inner city, somewhere where people look like me. And basically calling me poor and black, if you know what I mean. And, like, telling me to my face and my mom's face that I just do not belong. And that was, like, really, really hard. Like, in front of, like, two kids, too. Like, it was the weirdest, probably, I don't know, experience I've ever had. And I think my mom ended up getting her, like, investigated and fired or something like that, because she wears that on her sleeve to, like, to this day. But it like really shook me. And she would always say things like about my hair, and accuse me of, like, stealing. And, like, this sounds crazy, but I guarantee, I, like, swear to God this happened, and nobody ever believes me except for, like, my mom, because she's, like, seen it. But she would give all the kids candy, and then she would skip me, and at the end of the day give me a piece of black licorice. Like, that is literally, I don't know why I said that British person, that is literally, like, something I have eyewitnesses to. And, like, I was, like, maybe six and seven when that was happening. And it's just like, wow. It's kind of funny, but every time I got my hair braided, that was like my 3-month therapy session with everybody who looked like me, my family, man. Like, I swear to God, I would be, like, excited to go get my hair done, because my, like, it'd be a salon full of aunties, man. Like, and they love me. I love them. But that was basically it. I could not find, kind of like you said at the beginning, I could not find a community in, like, the Northeast or anywhere other than where they did my hair that they, that I could really, like, relate to, or that they would even kind of, like, accept me as.
I really think I formed BSU out of a need to create that space, like that safe space for not only myself, but in thinking about, I've got a younger sister that's about 4 years behind me, and just imagining her navigating social circles the same way that I did, not having that space where she could engage with her Black peers or engage with non-white peers, and talk through some of those challenges of like being the only Black kid in the class, or what do you do when you're in a car full of your white friends and they all want to say the N-word. Like, we needed those conversations in those spaces as a kid, and a safe space to do that. And so that was a big push for me to start the BSU. I also felt like at the time there was a Latino student union, and I think there was a Gay Straight Alliance, and like a Jewish student union. And it felt weird to me that, as traditional, culturally traditional our community is, that we didn't have another one, or we didn't have any sort of multicultural anything. So I wanted to get that started. I just felt like it was necessary, like rooted in tradition, like it's part of our culture, right? Like, we add this here. So it took some promotion. I think I had to like market the club to get an advisor to like sign off on it. But I did have a vice principal at the time, was amazing, and he was super into the idea of creating a Black student union, so he helped advise it. Unfortunately, when he left, that was the challenge of the next year, was like finding another advisor to take it over. My political action seminar teacher agreed to help advise, and honestly, there wasn't like any structural things that I got from them. Like, it was just so that we could be in the yearbook per se. Majority of the meetings we had at my house, just because we had one meeting at the school and everyone was like, this is not a safe space to talk. So I was like, okay, we're gonna move the meetings to my house and my mom will make dinner. So we started doing meetings at my house, dinner. And I think initially my goal was to like be more of like a committee or a council. Like, I wanted to enact change, but what the BSU morphed into really was therapy space for us to get together and have a meal together and talk through the challenges and the difficulties of navigating high school as a Black kid in predominantly white spaces. And the camaraderie I found through that was just amazing. Like, I really made some really good connections from that group that are lifelong to me. And I think having the knowing that other teenagers were experiencing really similar things as me allowed me to feel a little bit safer in my spaces and allowed me to breathe a little bit and sleep a little bit more at night. I think I was really, really struggling with feeling isolated like my junior and senior year. And I think that that is just a normal feeling of being a teenager, going through like emotions and friendships, relationships. Teenager, it's like a very hormonally changing time, right? And so you're feeling these really big things all the time, not knowing how to process them. So having that space really, it created that sense of safety for me. And I saw the way that it created sense of safety for other in the group too, and I just wanted to continue to foster that space and create safety.
So for me, color was a way that I could indirectly just be like, this may sound a little bad, but like, look at how you guys have affected all these other people, all these students of color, and you guys just all brush over it. It was kind of my way of just like indirectly writing to Lake Oswego students, Lake Oswego teachers, everything. So I was interested in starting a color again for that reason, just to have this outlet almost to share my thoughts without having to like deal with, I would say, the repercussions of when you actually confront a white person and they start getting super defensive, like, I'm not racist, I just, and they start stammering and trying to come up with excuses as to why they're not actually racist. And so I did it with two of my friends who I know who are also great writers and also passionate, Serena Lump and Cameron Azuka. And we worked together to bring this magazine back. And we published one issue before life got its hold on us again. But I would say I'm very proud of that issue and the work we put into it, because all three of us did end up writing very personal stories of being students of color in LOSD that I think that is one of my more impactful pieces I've ever released, just because I feel like people started to understand that, like, oh, these stories of racism aren't just things you hear on the news or things that you kind of know about, but people you know are experiencing it as well, which I liked because it didn't require me having to deal with directly talking to someone and defending my right to exist in Lake Oswego. I would honestly say the responses are like positive and negative to a certain degree, because I would say a lot of the people that did end up reaching out, they were like, we really love your writing, like, we really support what you said. But then it was like, how much do they actually support me? Because we ended up wanting to share our, like, expand our audience. And there was actually LO administration that was like, oh, we're willing to share it. And we were like, okay. So we sent them the link and we were like, here, we finished editing all of color and we actually published it. Like, we would love if you would share it with the community. And then we started getting a little bit of like BS excuses of why they couldn't. Cause then they were like, oh, like there's curse words on the cover. Like it's not appropriate. So then we were like, Serena actually went back and took the time to unpublish the work, go back in and censor the curse words and then republish it, only for us to then get a real response of why they didn't want to share it. And it's because we used the term ACAB, which the school just seemed, the administration just saw as so offensive and so controversial. And I thought this was honestly a little offensive because they said, how do you feel using the term ACAB, something that I see like gangsters and pubs use? Which then I was like, why are we being compared to gangsters and pubs now? Like, communities, like, communities of color that are using ACAB are because people like them are getting wrongfully arrested, killed, hurt by cops. But it's suddenly wrong for us to say that this institution is flawed and that they're bad. And suddenly we're gangsters for doing so.
From what I remember, it seemed like there was two ways of the district trying to respond or at least bring some sort of community discussion about SROs. And I remember being part of like a focus group where they were having, in my case, students talk about their views on SROs being in schools, but they also had focus groups with parents, admin, maybe community members as well. And I don't trust people with guns. I don't want guns or, you know, weapons in my presence. So I just would always avoid them when I see, you know, officers in the halls. And I wasn't worried about retaliation against myself. But it would be, again, like a sort of mentioned earlier, it's like more worrying about people like my brother. And I remember that focus group, and it was just me and two other buddies, and we were all on the same page. We're like, we do not want officers and like armed people around us. And mentioning how it's like, of course you're going to have problems that we see elsewhere with police, with, you know, targeting Black and brown people. I don't know why you want to instill fear in a learning environment, because that seems counterproductive. But I just remember being really frustrated when the district's whole report came out afterwards, where they were showing the different comments made by students versus parents versus community members in admin. And I remember there was a quote from some admin who was like belittling the students' responses and saying essentially like, oh, that, you know, they shouldn't matter because, oh, you know, they're kids and, you know, we have their safety at heart and, you know, their best interests at heart. And I'm like, oh my God. It wasn't an admin. It was like either a parent or a community member who said that. And I'm like, you're not the one in the building with people with guns. How do you think you have the authority here to, you know, say that and just you know, just diss the perspectives of the people who are going to be most affected by their presence. And then I also remember the district saying like, oh, well, we also want to keep in mind, you know, in light of, you know, some of the student criticism about cops being in schools, by remembering that it was students who demanded that SROs be present after, you know, the Parkland shooting, because everybody's worried about school shootings. And that's understandable to be scared about school shootings, but just like, we've seen so many cases of school shootings where the police officers at the school are not effective and they just stand there or they run away or whatnot. So it was just bogus. And it seemed like they had these listening sessions, but they didn't want to deal with anything that they heard when it came to things that conflicted with their, you know, status quo. That really pissed me off reading, you know, a community member statement that's essentially dissing the perspectives and whatnot of the people who are actually going to be on in the building with the people with the gun. So I think it's just, I don't know, it's bogus, and I don't think they're going to try to remove SROs at any time soon.
I mean, on the topic of SROs, it was, I think, over spring of 2021, where I sat down for, I think, maybe an hour or 2 hours with, like, third-party representatives who were working with the school board to talk about, it was, like, one of those situations where they hire outside people and then get all of the student data that shows very clearly how the student body feels about something, but then they also consult parents who have like misinformation, where at least in this scenario it was like talking about SROs and the broad student perspective from both like BIPOC students and students with disabilities was that they don't feel safe. They have had uncomfortable or fearful interactions with the school police officer. And then the same third party people talk to the parents of students and they say, no, I think that the school is safer with this police officer. I think that if there was a school shooting, he would protect them, or some kind of argument about, again, the perpetuation of like violence and how a good guy with a gun could stop a bad guy with a gun, where when we had probably one of the most severe like school shooter threats while I was in high school, it was because it was an off-duty cop who didn't sign in through the high school registration system. Someone saw him with his gun in the building, told the front office. They had an entire lockdown of the building while he was supposed to be there for a classroom lecture and discussion with one of the social studies teachers, where it's like, in that scenario, also the school resource officer who was supposed to be on call had his kidney stones removed and was in the hospital. So even if we were going along the argument that cops stop school shootings, which they don't, that wasn't even a good example. But in this like hyper vigilant scenario where somehow mainly white parents are under the impression that they both are safe and also are under the threat of like of violence, it seems like the school board just put together another task force and said, okay, we'll consider removing school resource officers now that we've collected information from actually hundreds of students across the district who said that they didn't support it, felt literally unsafe, under duress, and also at the same time were forced to continue to go to school in this like unsafe environment where it's just it's not even necessarily bureaucracy, but it's just kind of like white comfort in many cases, where I think at least in other spaces that I've been in outside of Lake Oswego, like whether it was now in college or in Peekskill or while I was in boarding school, it just seems like that's a recurring theme that no longer surprises me. And I think that that's like also something that people talk about often, as far as like you always hope that you're going to be surprised, or you hope that you are like giving someone the opportunity to really learn from when you're perhaps calling someone in or calling an action out, and taking the time and empathy to like connect over something and like educate. But then you just feel so many of these washing moments where, oh, you just proved me right. You just like affirmed that you would rather stand with like white unity over my like genuine concerns for health, safety, my ability to live, like other human rights that just are able to be ignored because it's an inconvenience.
Let's talk about racism, but let's not talk about politics because we don't want to alienate these people. And it's like, you're so interested in not alienating people who are actively causing us harm, and you're not making any type of effort to make us feel good at all. And it's just that time old story of like, what about us? You know, like, where's all this? Why aren't you worried about us? Why do we have to do all this work to make people who are hurting us feel better when no one, not even you, who's supposedly on our side, is doing anything to make us feel not that bad?
It became especially clear from working with Next Up and also just doing some reflection work, is how a lot of the sort of projects that the district or administration tried to get me and some of my peers to be involved in was really just co-optation. Yeah, and it's just all that free labor stuff. But yeah, I think if I was to apply more of the lessons that I learned from Next Up and other political organizing, it was just to be more critical. I think we could have laid it on a bit thicker in terms of criticism and pointing out where the admin are going wrong, and point out be more obvious in terms of why their intentions are misguided in many cases. Because first of all, we were asked by the district to be there, and we were the ones who were willing to show up, you know, after school hours to do this work. And so if these are all the voices they're getting, we might as well, you know, be the ones to point out, you know, how they could improve, because they're not going to find people who really want to spend time out of school doing this work otherwise.
I don't even know how to describe it, but I know that like in my last year there, when the administration was maybe attempting to take steps to make things better, I think I came out of that feeling very used and confused, and kind of just like, what was that? Like, what just happened? Because I and other students, we put in a lot of effort for things. It's hard, bro. Like, I'm thinking about it now and I can't even get a grasp on it. I think part of it is because I've pushed it so far to the recesses of my memory. But yeah, I feel like at times we were kind of, I don't even know the word, but just kind of, yeah, no, used and propped up. I can think of one instance, someone who I will not name. It's not a big deal or anything, but a teacher who came up to me one time and started asking me all of these questions about race and like was really interested in stuff. But when I think back to it, I get a little bit off put because I'm like, I was like a 16-year-old kid. I don't necessarily feel like I should have been the one that you're coming to with this stuff. I feel like a lot of times the children of color, emphasis on children, we were treated like adults. And I don't appreciate that because we weren't really given the same chance to stumble around and figure ourselves out.
I loved having the platform and the ability to express and have my voice heard by the community. I loved the fact that I had channels and avenues that allowed me to put on forums and create the student union and continue to highlight different race problems in our community. I think the piece that I struggled with, and I didn't struggle with it until after the fact, was the educational, like the training, the teaching aspect of it. I wasn't on LOSD's salary, but somehow I helped facilitate racial equity trainings and like brought in speakers to talk about like race in Oregon, like those kinds of things. I was so passionate as a kid that I wanted to do these things, as a teenager, that I wanted to do these things. But that wasn't my, like, that shouldn't have been, there needed to have been an adult to say, I love this energy. How can we take this and help create this in a more structured way, in a way that is long-term? So it's not just a one-off from an excited kid in the class of 2017 that got to put on a couple events. It's no recurring. You have the Civil Rights Attorney of Oregon coming to do these presentations every year for these economic classes. Like, that's what needed to happen. And I think that's where us as a community, we're losing the momentum, and we want to highlight these teenagers and highlight the voices that are the front lines, because teenagers are often the front lines of this experience. But we're not taking the tangibles from what they're saying and moving on them. That's the piece that I'm really struggling with, is that, like, Bruce, I feel like we have had this conversation for years. Like, we've been talking about these things for years. And it's great. I want to keep the conversation alive, but how do we move the needle where we're actually making this tangible change?
And it's wild when I've seen, like, people from like Oswego in like recent years that are younger that are super confident or that like rep Lake Oswego, and I'm like, how do you pull this off? I'm like, well, there's a factor that changes it, but you know, it's just like that's not something that a black or brown person would be bragging about in any context.
I never, when there's an opportunity to mention, you know, where I'm from or where I grew up at, you know, I never will say, you know, where I was from or where I grew up at, unless someone asked me directly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, I had you know, not an incredible amount of trauma, but just enough trauma where it was like, you know, I don't want to be associated with that. I hate telling people like, oh, I'm from Lake Oswego, because in my soul, like, I'm not, you know what I mean? Like, that just comes with too much baggage that I don't deserve.
This has been the Bruce Poinsett Show. Again, you can catch us every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7, or you can catch clips on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett. If you want access to exclusive bonus coverage, you can go to patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. And make sure to follow us on Twitch at twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM. That's numbers with a Z. Or on the Numbers Podcast Network on all podcasting platforms, or thenumberspodcast.com. Again, that's numbers with a C.